You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, antibiotic-resistant infections are a big problem. They're often contracted in the places where we go for health care. We'll find out about the newest approaches to treating and preventing those superbugs. Now, the deadline for the state budget is getting closer, and lawmakers are releasing more details on the priorities for education funding. Assembly Republicans held a news conference today to release their education spending plans. That comes after legislative leaders met with Governor Evers to talk about K-12 funding earlier this morning. Sean Johnson is WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
So one of the big questions is, will the state return to its so-called two-thirds funding commitment to public schools? What are we seeing from all parties concerned here?
I'm not sure that we can say we've seen everything from all parties concerned because we don't know where Senate Republicans are exactly on this. But under the plan released today by Assembly Republicans, according to them, it would bring the state back to picking up two-thirds of the cost of education. That's something that used to be a law in Wisconsin. It hasn't been for some time. And under this budget, and certainly under Governor Evers' budget, the state would hit that two-thirds benchmark.
So give us big picture, Sean. What kind of changes Assembly Republicans are talking about when it comes to school funding?
So big picture, we'll compare it to the governor's budget here. I mean, Governor Evers campaigned on a $1.4 billion increase in school funding. The budget he proposed would increase school funding by about $1.4 billion. The budget Assembly Republicans talked about kind of, we didn't see all the details today, but they talked about a $500 million increase in school funding. So, you know, roughly a third of what the governor wanted, or you put it another way, it's $900 million less than what the governor proposed, which is pretty substantial. Big piece of the governor's budget is a $606 million increase in special education funding. Assembly Republicans would increase special ed funding, but not nearly by as much. They're talking about a $50 million increase in special ed funding. So that accounts for a big drop-off in their budget compared to the governor's budget in just sheer dollar terms.
Now, this comes after a meeting this morning, I think, between Governor Evers and some of the Republican leadership. What do we know about what went on there?
We don't know much about what went on in the meeting. And, you know, as much as they've kind of gone after each other in public, they've been sort of nice today. In fact, after Republicans released their budget today, you know, Governor Evers wasn't out there saying, I'm going to veto this or this is outrageous or anything like that. I mean, he has certainly issues with this plan, but, they apparently had a cordial conversation this morning and they've agreed to keep it mostly private.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief, about education funding plans so far in state budget proposals from the governor and from Assembly Republicans. Sean, state school funding is kind of a tough issue to talk about. Republicans might say Governor Walker increased school funding in his last budget. Democrats would say, but he cut the budget to schools before that. But Republicans would say, but that was balanced out by savings from Act 10. Is there a lot of apples and oranges comparison going on when people point toward what's been happening with school funding?
There is, but I guess so you search for the apples, right? You search for areas where you have similar measures. And so if you want to look at this budget that Assembly Republicans are proposing, it's a $500 million increase. They're touting this budget, this education budget, as this, you know, the largest ever in Wisconsin. And so what they're talking about there is the total budget. So, by that measure, pretty much every budget that doesn't have cuts is the largest ever in Wisconsin. But this budget increase, this $500 million increase, is actually smaller than the final increase that Governor Walker signed into law. So Governor Walker's last budget would have increased state funding for K-12 schools by more than $600 million. This one is short of that.
And Governor Evers is calling for a more substantial increase. Do we know, Sean, about how the different parties are looking to pay for their increases or saying how it would be paid for?
This is something that Assembly Republicans brought up today. They are, you know, not going to have any kind of income or sales tax increase in their budget. They said they've already taken the governor's in the budget committee anyway. They took out the governor's plan to expand Medicaid in Wisconsin, which would free up about $320 million in state funding. They got rid of the governor's plan to scale back a tax credit for manufacturers, and they got rid of the governor's plan to scale back a state capital gains tax exemption. So those two things there, the manufacturers tax and the capital gains exemption, by not doing those things that Evers wanted to do, they have about $1 billion less to work with. And then you add in Medicaid, and it's about $1.3 billion or so less to work with. And you start to see why they have less money to work with for schools than the governor did, and it would be very hard for them to hit that, you know, $1.4 billion increase that he did without that kind of revenue.
One issue a lot of people have been following, Sean, is funding for rural districts often facing declining enrollment. They're having a hard time getting teachers in under their current budgets. Do Governor Evers or Assembly Republicans tackle that issue in their budget proposals?
That one they both tackle, and without having seen a summary from the legislature's nonpartisan budget office of what one side would do compared to the other side, because the Assembly GOP plan is sort of in concept right now. They did talk about rural school funding, but I'm not as familiar with that portion of the budget and how it would compare with Governor Evers.
Now, we've seen Assembly Republicans, this is kind of their response to Governor Evers' budget proposal. Have we seen Democrats yet respond to what we heard from Republicans earlier today?
Yeah, I mean, Democrats in throughout this budget process have pretty much had the governor's back. I mean, they have been there on the budget committee advocating for whatever Governor Evers proposed, really. And so in this case, they are advocating for the budget he proposed in February that includes that $1.4 billion increase in overall education funding and the $600 million increase in special ed funding.
So, Sean, what happens next now in the budget process, which obviously includes the education issue and all the other stuff, too?
So, in theory, the legislature's Joint Finance Committee is going to vote on the education budget tomorrow. So, at some point, Assembly Republicans and Senate Republicans are getting on the same page. And they're going to, I don't know if this $500 million increase will be the number, but they're going to agree on a number. And they're going to agree on the rest of the budget. And they're going to vote on it. And the process kind of goes from there. But the process is not done there. I mean, it still has to pass the full legislature. Governor Tony Evers still has, you know, veto power if the budget comes to him the way that it normally does in one bill. There's some question about whether that'll happen, but as of right now, that's, you know, probably the plan. And so the process is long. Even if tomorrow the budget committee votes on this stuff, it might not be done.
And the state has a deadline when it has to finish the budget, but the state doesn't shut down, as we've talked about before, Sean. If they don't agree on something, we just ride with the current budget, right?
Yeah, but I think where it really starts to, you start to feel the pressure if you're a legislator is later in the year, school funding deadlines can become more, I guess, severe or more pressing. So, if they don't pass a budget by June 30th, you know, July 1 hits, the world is pretty much the same as it was. But if you start getting into that school year, then, you know, the budget were to drag out into September, October, the last time that happened, schools started, you know, freaking out a little bit, because then the decisions that they're making here start to affect local budgets and what they can plan for. So it gets to be more of a headache.
Sean, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, Capital Bureau Chief for WPR, with us to talk about where negotiations stand between Republicans in the legislature and Governor Tony Evers over school funding in the state budget. Coming up, we continue our series on alcohol in Wisconsin with a look at women in the brewing industry. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk with a brewmaster who's part of an effort to get more women interested and involved with craft beer. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about another Wisconsin brewer. It's part of WPR's ongoing series exploring Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol.
Erica DeAnda is a brewer at Wanakee's Octopi Brewing. While she's a young, tenacious woman, she describes her brewing and drinking style as being very much the opposite.
I kind of tell people that my brewing style is very much like a 40-year-old man who just discovered craft beer in the 90s. And when I say that to brewers, they kind of understand where I'm coming from. I like old school hops. I like a malty backbone. I like clarity.
WPR's Jenny Peek visited Deanda at Octopi Brewing to learn more about how she got into the craft and what it's like to be a female in a male-dominated industry. The world of craft beer opened up for Erica Deanda 4 years ago during a tasting class at a high-end brew pub in Oakland, California. A recent hire, the owners had Deanda and her coworkers taste a variety of brews so they could aptly describe them to their customers.
I knew nothing about beer at that point except for I did not like it at all. You know, it was disgusting. Give me a pink drink. I don't want beer. One of our first, like, training days, they had us trying some, you know, like, really fancy bottles. And I remember trying a beer, and I just remember it had, like, this oaky kind of tart. It almost reminded me of, like, a Chardonnay. And I just was in awe that this was beer. It wasn't bitter, it wasn't harsh, it was kind of like sweet and just had all these different characteristics. Then I'm like, I need to know more.
After 4 years of completely immersing herself in the world of brewing, Deanda, now 28, is a brewer at Octopi Brewing in Wanakee and the chapter president of Wisconsin's Pink Boot Society, an international nonprofit that supports women working in the brewing profession. While it was a quiet day at Octopi when I went to meet Deanda, she had a lot to say about how being a part of the society has helped her make connections and get inspiration along the way.
It's important to feel like you're connected to people who kind of are, you know, similar to you. And I think for me, it's also been a big inspiration to meet other women who work in this industry, and not only work, but are dominating this industry, especially when it's, you know, kind of a boys' club, so to speak. For me, it's always been the inspiration. I got into brewing. I was really confused as to where I was going with my life. When I found the Pink Boot Society, it was very much like I was working in a tap room. I went to my first collaboration brew day where I met a couple of women brewers out in California. And just seeing what they were accomplishing and seeing how dedicated they were to their job, it was like, I want to do that and I can do that.
Beyond creating a platform for women in the beer industry, Deanda says the Pink Boot Society and the rise in women brewers is transforming beer culture.
I also think with the Me Too movement, sexual harassment in the brew house is kind of becoming like a big prominent issue. I've been reading a lot of stories about brewers who have harassed bartenders and things like that. And like I said, the guys who I work with are all supportive. And so I think that, you know, we can all kind of come together and be a driving force. But I think women can be a powerhouse to kind of knock some of these things that have been disregarded for so long. There's a misconception that we're like all these like feminists and we don't want boys in the club and things like that. We do. We want allies. We want people supporting us. We're just trying to encourage other people and to push anybody into this beer industry and advance women's careers as much as we possibly can.
For up-and-coming women brewers, Deanda says to never stop trying.
I always like to say when someone shuts a door in your face, just go through the window. Don't let anybody tell you no, you can't do it. Also, don't stand in your own way. It just takes a lot of hard work and dedication. This isn't something that just happens overnight, but if you really dedicate your time to it, you can be a force to be reckoned with in the beer industry, I think.
Why can't women have a good beer drinking song?
That story came to us from WPR's Jenny Peek. It's part of WPR's project High Tolerance, a deep dive into Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol. To hear all the stories, go to WPR.org/alcohol. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now we continue the conversation about women in brewing in Wisconsin. Ashley Kennard Short is a brewmaster at Capital Brewery in Middleton. Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
What was your road to becoming a brewmaster?
Well, I started out, I grew up just outside of Milwaukee, so beer has kind of been part of my life, I guess pretty much all of it. So I kind of grew up around beer. I've always loved beer. Miller High Life was kind of one of the things just around growing up. It wasn't until later in college that I started drinking more craft beer and getting to some of the Pick Six you know, all the stuff you can just go and get a whole bunch of different beers and try all kinds of crazy stuff. I was really excited about trying new things. But at that point, I had no idea that this was going to be a career kind of move for me. So I started bartending just to pay for college. I have a biology degree from UW-Madison here. So that was kind of made sense to me to bartend through college. And I just absolutely fell in love with craft beer. I was bartending at a craft beer bar, the Old Fashioned, which is all Wisconsin craft beers. And that was just really inspiring to see all these local people, a lot of them really small companies that were making this amazing, amazing stuff. More and more went into it and graduated and realized that maybe this is going to be where my life is going to go.
And that biology degree, I imagine, comes in handy, dealing with a lot of microorganisms.
Yes, absolutely. I always like to say, like, hey, I not only graduated with the UW degree, but I'm also using my major almost every day, which is good to say. You don't hear a lot of that nowadays.
Now, we heard in that Wisconsin Life piece, Erica DeAnda definitely saw it as a guy's club in a lot of ways. Maybe surprise when people see a woman being a brewmaster. Have you encountered that yourself?
Oh, absolutely. It's still the sheer numbers are just massive. I mean, I think it's a lot of just not that many women have been into beer for a very long time. I like to kind of liken it to women are a little more into complex flavor and maybe perhaps have a little more of a complex palate. So 30 years ago, there was almost nothing but, you know, light, fizzy, yellow lagers, and they didn't really have much flavor to them. But now we've got, you know, loads and loads of different styles, all different flavors up and down the flavor profiles. And so I think a lot more women are getting behind it. And so our numbers are still small, but we're getting there.
And you're involved in the Pink Boots Society. It's PBS, not the PBS a lot of our listeners may be familiar with. Talk about what you do with that and the role it's played for you and other women.
Yeah. So and I've been in the Pink Boots Society, I want to say, for about at least 6 years now. I've been with Capital Brewery. So that's kind of when I first joined. And it's a professional club. So it's for people who work in the beer industry in some way, shape, or form. But they're definitely not picky. As long as you make money from beer, and that can be, you can kind of find an alternative way by selling bottle cap earrings on Etsy or something like that, you can join. And so it's focused on educating women on, we want beer, especially craft beer, to be women's beverage of choice. But we also focus a lot on educating women. A lot of scholarship money goes towards brewing programs, business of brewing programs, and all different kind of just learning opportunities to help more women get more involved in the brewing community and find a great career there.
I want to talk about the creative side of being a brewmaster. I know at least people I've known who tried to homebrew, they go from a stage where they're like, okay, how do I replicate that kind of beer to how do I come up with my own twist? How do I put my own stamp on this? Are you at that point?
Oh, absolutely. Coming into Capital, I was going into an existing amazing brewery that had been around for almost 30 years when I first started. And we had a really good stronghold in the German-style lager category. And we still, to this day, make a ton of really great beers. But they were just starting to kind of break out of that mold and do some more ales, a handful of IPAs here and there. And actually, just last summer, we installed a 7-barrel brewing system, which our main brew house is about 35 barrels. So we do a lot of stuff on a little bit larger scale. But this pilot system, I'm kind of coming up with all brand new styles. They're small batches, so they're very experimental. This last year I've just spent, you know, almost a new beer is coming out almost every single week. And it's super exciting. And I have basically the world at my fingertips for ingredients, yeast, different yeast strains, hop varietals, different malting types. It's all just amazing. And there's so many things out there for me to play with.
Talking to Ashley Kennard Short. She's a brewmaster for Capital Brewery in Middleton. All right, you've got these different projects. If it's not an industrial trade secret, can you talk about some of the mad scientist experiments you're working on right now?
Absolutely. I guess one of them is kind of bringing back a beer we haven't done for about 3 years, and it's kind of not really reinventing the wheel, but just kind of going back to old recipes and kind of taking things that maybe ingredients aren't readily available anymore. So we're going to be re-releasing our Island Wheat beer that we've done for a long time. But just this afternoon, I was putting together I made a honey lemon ginger infused beer for a little event we have at the brewery tonight. And just kind of playing with all different kinds of flavors. It's nowadays beers are kind of anything and the kitchen sink can go into a beer. So it's fun to see all the cool infusions, concoctions, and different things people got.
So for women who might be listening and have thought about going into making beer, maybe just, you know, on their own for themselves and friends, or trying to get into the business, what advice would you have for them?
Go for it. I found myself just absolutely immersing every part of my life into craft beer, not only working and asking for more responsibilities at work, asking to help with even just counting the beers, the beer inventory, going to beer fest, talking to brewers, asking to volunteer either at tap rooms or at breweries. I mean, I first started at Capital for free and was basically asked if I could just hose down the floors and, you know, scrub tanks, which there's a lot of that going on. And so
glamour work.
Yeah, absolutely. And they say that, you know, 90% of brewing is cleaning. So we always have an extra cleaning to do here and there. So just kind of put yourself in the right position. Go seek out opportunities where you're either given opportunities because you're that one who's always there willing to help out anytime they need a hand. And you're going to be the first one they pick when they do need a hand or where they're looking to hire for somebody. So,
and are there any exciting trends you're seeing out there in the beer world, whether they're happening in your brewery or outside of it?
I think with all the really crazy stuff going on these past few years, I mean, the hazy IPAs, the milkshake IPAs, you know, a lot of really cool sour beers. It's really fun to see how like really old school traditional lagers have really made their way back around. In Wisconsin, we've always been doing that. We've got this huge German heritage that, you know, pilsners and really nice light lagers have been part of a lot of the older breweries' portfolios pretty much forever. But the rest of the country is kind of just catching back up and really starting to refine their kind of lager brewing. And so that's really fun to see that we've always done it, but it's kind of a new trend, a new thing. So that's what I've been very excited about, not only drinking, but continuing to find new ones that we haven't made yet.
Ashley, thanks a lot for coming into the studio.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
That's Ashley Kennard-Short, the brewmaster at Capital Brewery. We talked with her about how she became a brewmaster in Wisconsin and what she's doing, in part with the Pink Boots Society, to help engage more women in craft brewing. Coming up, antibiotic-resistant superbugs are all around us, and it's difficult for research to keep pace with them. We'll get the inside story on the race to treat some of the most dangerous infections out there. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on the morning show, there's growing demand for naloxone, the expensive anti-overdose drug, but sometimes it's sitting on shelves past its expiration date. Find out more tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, many a horror movie is focused on a rapidly spreading infection that's immune to all medical treatment. It might not look as dramatic as it does in the movies, but there's growing concern about real-life infections that have developed a resistance to the antibiotics and antifungal medications in our medical toolkit. The medical community is worried about these rapidly evolving superbugs and the difficulty in bringing effective new medications and treatments to market. Our next guest shares the inside story of the race to stay ahead of those diseases. Dr. Matt McCarthy is an assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell and a staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. His new book out this week is Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. Dr. McCarthy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you tell the history in the book of antibiotics, and in some ways they've been around with us for thousands of years, but as far as something that's been produced on purpose and used on large scale, this is less than a century old technology. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, this is what fascinated me is that humans have been ingesting antibiotics for millennia, whether they knew it or not. If you go in to look at the bones of the mummies that we have exhumed from Africa and from Egypt, we find that inside the bones they have antibiotics such as tetracycline. And they didn't even necessarily know how this was working, but they knew that something in the food that they were eating had a special property. And what I was focused on, especially in my book, was how we came to commercialize these products. And I start with penicillin, which was the first commercially available antibiotic. And that ushered in what we called the golden era of antibiotic development and of drug discovery. And the 1950s produced this array of life-saving medications that actually got us to a point where we could extend life far beyond what we had ever predicted. And that sets the stage for what I end up writing about, which is how these antibiotics that were so valuable and so essential are starting to not work anymore. And I wanted to figure out why that happened, and then more importantly, what we can do about it.
Right. And the short answer to why is evolution happening pretty quickly. A lot of dangerous bacteria have just evolved resistances, it sounds like, to the drugs we've been using to treat them.
You nailed it. And this, is, to me, was the most fascinating part of my research for the book, was finding out all of the ingenious ways that bacteria are evolving to evade the antibiotics that we throw at them. And two of the specific examples I write about are things called efflux pumps, which are these microscopic vacuum cleaners that the bacteria have created that can suck up an antibiotic and then just spit it out. And one of the other things I talk about are these metalloproteinases, which are specific enzymes that can chop up any antibiotic that we give it. And so what I'm looking at is, okay, now that we recognize that the bacteria are outfoxing us, what do we do about it? How do we invest in antibiotics in a strategic way so that the next time you go into the hospital is armed with an armamentarium of drugs that can save your life?
Talking to Dr. Matt McCarthy about his new book, Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. And you talk through the book about your work on a trial for a new antibiotic. And the heart of your book, in a lot of ways, isn't a science or medical story. It's a human story. You share the stories of the people you talk to who ultimately chose or didn't choose or weren't able to participate in these trials. Can you talk about the importance of meeting the people behind this drug testing?
You know, absolutely. What I found over the past, you know, I'm an infectious disease specialist, and over the past 5 years is I see all of these articles written about the bacteria or about these policy proposals, but the thing that was being left out were the patients. And that's the reason I went into medicine, is that I love interacting with patients and being at the bedside and talking to people. And the book really generated out of a question that a patient asked me several years ago, which was, why is it so hard to make a new antibiotic? And what I wanted to do was bring readers into the hospital to see what kind of decisions doctors are being faced to make, and also to see the patients and see what kind of things they're having to deal with infections. You know, the infections that I could treat with an oral antibiotic 10 years ago, I then had to switch to an intravenous antibiotic 5 years ago because the pills were no longer working. And then in the past few years, I've found that these intravenous treatments are not working. And what's terrifying is that the big pharma is not particularly interested in coming up with new drugs, new antibiotics, because they don't turn enough of a profit for them. So I wanted to make readers feel what it's like to be at the bedside of a patient with an infection for which there was no treatment, and the reason being that the profit margins were too slim, because it outrages me, and I want other people to recognize what's going on inside of our hospitals.
Let's stay on that issue. Do you see a solution to that problem? These are drugs that somebody's not going to take every day for the rest of their lives, like my reflux medication, say. It's harder to make money on them. Is there a way to fill that gap and make more of that research happen?
Absolutely. And this is going to be the most important political issue that no one is yet talking about. Antibiotics are by definition a market failure, which means that the free market of supply and demand does not account for the fact that we need more of these drugs. And it means when you have a market failure that you need a government intervention. And so what we're going to be hearing, probably not for another 6 months or so, is a number of proposals put on the table to spur the investment of investment of antibiotics. And these are called pull incentives and push incentives. And so these are ways to get these companies to make new drugs. So I'll give you an example of a push incentive is to say to a $1 billion company, your corporate tax rate is 20%. We'll cut it in half if you promise to invest $100 million in antibiotics. Now, the idea of giving a tax break to a multi-billion-dollar company makes a lot of us, you know, think twice, but that's kind of the proposal that we're thinking about. And then another thing is a pull incentive, which is to say to a company, if you're able to make a new antibiotic that's a life-saving treatment, rather than giving you 5 to 7 years of market exclusivity, as we normally do, we'll give you 25 years so that no one can challenge the patent on that. Again, this is all just so that they can have an interest in making new drugs, because as I quote one pharmaceutical CEO in my book, says he has an ethical mandate to charge as much money as possible for antibiotics because he's accountable to shareholders, not patients.
Speaking of ethics, that's another theme in your book. And you talk about the early days of antibiotic development having, among others, two ethical nightmares. Testing of prisoners under Nazi Germany, horrific testing. And then here in the United States, the Tuskegee experiments allowing people to go untreated, not even knowing that they had syphilis for years. What kind of ethical lessons do we learn from those two nightmares?
Well, you know, these are things that are mentioned in passing in a lot of medical ethics textbooks, but I wanted to do a deep dive into both of these because at the heart of both of these horrors is an antibiotic. It's the issue that we had penicillin available for the patients in Tuskegee who we withheld it from them. We didn't even tell them that there was a treatment for syphilis. And then looking at what was going on with the Nazi doctors and the experiments that they were doing on patients with antibiotics, these things are horrifying. And I wanted to set the stage to show just how many safeguards are now in place, because in many cases we could not trust doctors to monitor themselves, to do ethically responsible research. And now that I'm on the ethics committee of my hospital, and I can tell you I was in an ethics committee meeting 45 minutes ago, these things we take care very seriously. And to run my trial, I had to go through 8 months of back and forth with an IRB, an institutional review board, to say, we want to make sure that if you're going to bring a new drug into the biggest hospital in Manhattan, we better be sure that it is safe for them. And not only that, but that you have adequate follow-up. And I wanted people to know that when you walk into a hospital, you know, you may be asked to participate in a clinical trial. And this book is to give you a bit of a guidebook to say, here's what may happen, here's why it might be a good idea or a not-so-good idea.
And you write about the frustration while you're in that eight-month process with that institutional review board. But in your, I think it's in your epilogue, you say, in hindsight, again, and you knew it all along, these are the good guys.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It delights me to speak with somebody who has read this book so closely, because you hit the nail on the head again, which is that these IRB people were driving me nuts. I just wanted to start my trial with a drug that I thought was going to help patients, and they kept saying, wait a second. We want to make sure that we understand what could happen to this drug if it got into somebody's sperm. Could it be passed on to a partner? Could it, you know, how inside and out every aspect of this drug I had to understand before I was allowed to give it to a patient. And despite my frustration at that, that's exactly how the process should work.
We're talking to Dr. Matt McCarthy about his new book, Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the risk of antibiotic-resistant infections? Have you encountered one yourself or for a loved one or maybe as a healthcare provider yourself? Do you have questions for Dr. McCarthy about his work on these issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Dr. Matt McCarthy about his new book, Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the government should be more involved in researching or promoting research on new treatments for antibiotic-resistant infections, maybe developing new antibiotics? Should drug companies be offered incentives? Have you, a loved one, been infected by a superbug, or have you seen this in your facility if you work in healthcare? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to a caller now. David is with us in Gurnee, Illinois. David, hi.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, a quick comment / question, I guess, for your guest there. You know, whenever I hear about pharmaceutical products, it's always the big bad pharma and how much they charge, how expensive drugs are. So I don't know that pharmaceutical companies can afford, if there is not enough margin, to try to develop a product like, you know, something that you're talking about. So I think the audience should understand, in the overall scheme of healthcare, I'm pretty sure the drugs themselves are less than 10%, whereas, you know, you have all these insurance companies and hospitals, everybody's making profit, a pharmaceutical company shouldn't? I just don't understand. So what's the incentive to the pharmaceutical companies to go after an epidemic like this if, to your point, there is really no margin because everybody's always asking?
Gotcha, David. Thanks for the call. Dr. McCarthy, your thoughts?
I completely agree. And, you know, if you read my book, I don't present Big Pharma as the bad guy. I quote a number of scientists who say we need the pharmaceutical industry because they have perfected the process of making these drugs. And the reason I describe this as a political issue is that we all recognize we need these drugs and that Big Pharma is not going to invest in them without some motivation. And we're going to have the government step in. And what I want people to understand is when this conversation comes up 6 months from now and your congressman or your state senator makes a proposal, I want readers to be able to understand and navigate and say, this is a good proposal or this is a bad proposal. And without an understanding of how desperate this issue is, I don't know that we can all be on the same page about it. You know, and I mentioned that one of the pharmaceutical companies is transferring some of their patents to a Native American reservation because they can invoke tribal exclusivity, and it's a way to make even more money off of the drugs that they have. And the fact that we've reached this breaking point where we're doing things like that means that the government needs to step in, but we want to make sure it does so in the right way.
David, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. McCarthy, I want to look at some of the frontiers of alternatives to antibiotics here. You write about, and NPR reports on today, CRISPR, gene editing technology being used to edit viruses to, check me on this, create proteins that can disrupt these infection-causing bacteria?
That's absolutely right, and it's one of the most exciting developments that's going on right now in molecular medicine, is that CRISPR is essentially a molecular scalpel where we can cut out sections of DNA and insert new sections. And it was one of the more thrilling parts for me to report on in my book. But the idea, and what's interesting about this, is that CRISPR can be used to create these new treatments, but they're not broad spectrum. They're very specific for certain pathogens. And when you say that, the companies that would make them get very nervous because they want very broad drugs that could treat a variety of illnesses. And CRISPR is a very expensive process to create a treatment for a specific illness. And that, I think, is going to require additional intervention to spur the companies to make those things. But CRISPR is a fascinating issue, both from the medical perspective, but also the ethical perspective, that we can fundamentally alter human DNA in a way that it's passed down to future generations.
And Dr. McCarthy, in our last couple minutes, it takes time to develop that kind of technology to develop a new antibiotic. How about stuff we can do now when it comes to A, hygiene, and B, how we prescribe antibiotics?
Yep. So I think to answer the second question first, how we prescribe antibiotics, right now there is far too much inappropriate use of it. I know the New York Times reported on Saturday of the widespread use of antibiotics in orange groves and that we're giving tuberculosis and syphilis drugs to the orange groves. And I've written about the antifungals that we use in tulip gardens to keep the flowers pretty. This is a problem. We can't be using the drugs in this capacity. And I can tell you another ethical issue that's coming is whether or not we should use our best antibiotics on our pets. Should your cat have access to these top-line antibiotics? There are people who would say absolutely yes and people who feel absolutely not. And, you know, I wrote this book because I feel like there are a number of conversations that are coming to the head that are going to be had in the next few years, and I want people to have an informed understanding of how complex this issue is. In terms of keeping your body healthy and what you can do, you know, it starts off with some rather mundane things like getting 8 hours of sleep a night, not drinking alcohol to excess, and washing your hands with soap and water. But another thing that people don't always know is to talk to your doctor and ask if you are somebody who is on a medication that impairs the immune system, or if you have a medical condition that impairs the immune system. A lot of my patients don't recognize that they are a moderate or high risk for infections, and they put themselves in danger. They may go into a musty basement, for example, that has mold in it. And if you have an intact immune system, that's not a big deal. But if you're on a certain subset of medications, that can put you at risk. And so I wanted to write sort of a guidebook so that people could understand just how to differentiate between low risk, moderate risk, and high risk.
Dr. McCarthy, thanks so much for joining us today.
This was wonderful. Thank you.
That's Dr. Matt McCarthy, assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell and staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. His new book out this week is Superbugs: The Race to Stop an Epidemic. In La Crosse County, about 80% of the cases that come before Child Protective Services involve alcohol and drug use. As part of our ongoing series, High Tolerance, Hope Kerwin reports on the toll adults drinking can take on the state's children.
Mike Desmond is the former director of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater La Crosse. That's how he met the child he and his wife Karen would eventually foster, a 14-year-old boy who we're calling Kay. Desmond says Kay and his brothers were living in a hotel with their mom, and it was clear there were problems. So one day, Desmond gave Kay his phone number.
And they called me shortly after that, and I went down to the hotel and picked up five of the six boys.
Desmond says the boys started living with them informally until they could get placements through the foster care system. And he felt like Kay and his brothers were finally getting the care that they longed for.
They love their mom, and their mom loves them. I just think with the alcohol, she wasn't always capable of giving them the attention and love that they needed.
Lila Barlow from La Crosse County's foster care program says Kay's situation is common. She says a parent's drinking often comes with use of other drugs, and many times they're using substances to cope with stress, trauma, or another mental health issue.
When you start putting that combination together, then we're looking at more of 90% of our cases have a mental health or a drug and alcohol combination of some sort. And to try to weed that out is really, really difficult.
Barlow says the number of substance-related cases has increased in recent years because of the rise in opioid use. But she says alcoholism has always been a problem, and it often goes undetected.
In a state like Wisconsin, where alcohol is a norm, it's socially accepted. I think it's very hard for the friends, the neighbors, the families to say someone has an alcohol issue.
Barlow says when friends or family members see a parent's alcohol use as normal, they justify when that parent gets too drunk to care for their children in a way they wouldn't if the parent was using drugs. But Tony Aniga says any kind of substance abuse by parents can have a huge impact on a child's future. He's an education specialist at Marshfield Clinic's Child Advocacy Center.
It really affects healthy brain development, which can lead to toxic stress or that toxic stress adaptation, where children then become very good at perceiving threat and fear, and they don't become very good at learning and viewing teachers and other adults as safe.
Aniga says when kids' brains are wired for surviving stress at home, they have a hard time focusing in class or even remembering basic instruction. But those kids are learning from their parents. Aniga says kids pick up on the ways their parents are using alcohol to cope with stress.
If the parent is reactive, if the parent is aggressive, if the parent is, you know, punching holes in the wall, that's what that child is learning.
Aniga says these kids need to have relationships with adults who don't depend on alcohol to understand there's a different way. People like Mike Desmond. Desmond says he tried to help Kay see what life is like without depending on alcohol. But he says Kay was already drinking when he first came to stay with him at the age of 14. And Desmond knows there's a good chance Kay could fall into alcoholism the same way his mom did.
Traumatized kids use. And they use for the same reason adults use. You're not happy with your life. You think your life's going nowhere. You have no self-esteem. And guess what? Alcohol deadens that pain.
But Aniga's argues it's not just kids in crisis who can learn unhealthy ways of coping from adults through alcohol.
When you have adults, parents, teachers, you know, people that even joke about having that glass of wine or that beer, you know, after work, after having a stressful day, kids start to make those associations that, you know, oh, that's the thing that basically helps me deal with stress.
Aniga says all adults, not just parents, need to be careful we're not passing down an unhealthy relationship with alcohol to the next generation. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there's a shortage of mental health care providers in many communities. A guest makes the case that psychiatric nurses could help fill that gap. Some American teachers are finding more lucrative educational careers by leaving the country. An education reporter tells us more. And we continue our series on alcohol and Wisconsin with a look at efforts in the state to change the culture when it comes to high-risk drinking. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.